question is basically that there's like a contradiction between the first three or four of the Rambam's Yigilei Karm. So that the first one is that God was the, really order. First one is God's the sole creator, and then the second one is God is one, and then the third one was,
I don't know. There's a contradiction.
That's the claim?
Not necessarily the
apparent
contradiction.
Apparent contradiction.
Contradiction may not be the right word, but like, well, some of them are like self-evident. Like, if you know the first one, then it must be that the second one's true. So what's the second one? Then what's the third one? So Rebbe had asked it as from like, if you know the third one, then you must know the second one. But
right.
When I was going through it, then I understood the question to be the opposite. If you know, I didn't bring the book that I was reading.
First one is God's existence, that there's this perfect existence, he's the cause of all their existence, and everything stems from him.
Right.
And if you can imagine him not existing, then everything else wouldn't exist. And if you can imagine everything else not existing, he would still exist. Right? Because he doesn't depend on them, and they don't depend on him. And they depend on him. Okay? Sounds good?
Right.
Second one is his oneness. That this cause is one, not like any other types of one, right? Totally different, but a one, absolutely one, right? Shmaisron. Third one is, he's not physical. He doesn't have a body, he's not, of course, in a body. Physical things don't happen to him, right? All that type of stuff.
Right.
Uh-huh.
So
that's the thing, is if he's one, the argument, I mean, the proof that he's not physical is because, otherwise he couldn't be one.
Right, so what is that one?
Right.
What's the distinction between
that and saying he's one?
Yeah.
Now I hear what you're saying. I mean, I think that...
Even from the first one, doesn't that make the third one more redundant?
Yeah. I mean, arguably, the first one maybe implies that he's one. If you have one underlying cause of everything, you could argue philosophically that it's one. That's a more sophisticated argument, but I think the Rambam holds that. Come on in! Come in! Right. See, mean, and then his next one is Kadmos, that he's like a necessary existence, the fourth one, right?
Right. So that one definitely doesn't make any sense, because...
Right. Hey,
of course, he created everything, and of course he was Kadmos, so what does it
mean? Right. Kadmos, right. He created everything from nothing. Well, that's a different point, actually. That's a separate one. Now, the first one is that he's the cause of everything. But there's two ideas of a cause. One is like Aristotle had the idea of a cause, that everything is, he's the cause of everything. But everything's eternal with him. Like with his existence comes everything else. But he's the cause, they're dependent on him and he's independent. But that's not creation, they're eternal just like him. But we hold, no, that God, the universe is finite, the universe is created. God's eternal and the universe is created. So the first one doesn't necessarily imply the third one, the fourth one. Because you could have an eternal, you could have a God as the cause of everything, but a cause...
How can a cause at the same time be infinite?
Let's say, I don't think it's exactly the example, but let's say you have like a shadow, a wall, so the wall is a shadow. So the wall doesn't mean that the wall preceded the shadow in time. The second you built the wall, there's a shadow. But the wall is the cause of the shadow. Right? It's not like there's a wall and then there's a shadow. Let's forget about nighttime. Let's say it's always, you know. So sometimes you can have something which is logically prior to the other. It's a cause. The shadow's existence is dependent upon the wall. The wall's existence isn't dependent upon the shadow. But it doesn't mean the wall existed before the shadow.
But in this case, isn't the first one that he's the cause of all existence?
Cause. Right, so it could be like the shadow. You're right, so it could be the wall is the cause of the shadow. But it doesn't mean that the wall... was before the shadow. Like, it could be that God exists eternally, and as an emergence from God is the universe, somehow. The universe stems from God's perfect existence, is that he brings with him a universe. But since he's eternal, the universe is eternal. But God is the cause of everything else. And if you'd imagine God wouldn't exist, it wouldn't exist. But imagine it wouldn't exist, God could still exist, because God causes the universe. That's what Aristotle held. Universe is eternal, but it depends upon God for its existence. but it's eternal. Right? Eternal doesn't mean, just because something's a cause doesn't mean that it precedes it in time. It could be eternal. They could both be eternal, but it's a cause.
Why is the word cause and not dependent?
That's what a cause means. It depends on its existence. For it, he causes its existence. That's what I mean. Depend. The category dependent is like, it means its existence is caused by his existence. It doesn't matter the semantics, but I mean, that's
right.
That's what it's saying. It's that he is the... What is it?
So the fourth one is that he's just... that he has no cause.
The fourth one?
Yeah.
The fourth one is that Cadmus means... No, that... that, he, that it's really Cadmus... that he existed without anything else. His existence does not depend... does not for the cause... No, there's a question is, why does the universe exist? The Aristotle held, because God exists... the universe exists. Must exist. We all, God, so to speak, decided to create it. God created it. That means God's existence is eternal, but there was God, the universe doesn't have to exist. Just because God exists, the universe doesn't have to exist. But God willed it to exist. And that's, in a certain sense, it creates more of a distance between God and the universe. As in Aristotle's idea, the universe is somehow emerges from God. It's like a closer connection between God and the universe.
There could still be like an evolution.
Evolution is a different point. Yeah.
No, meaning in regarding, like let's say like the Big Bang. There was no Big Bang.
According to
Aristotle.
Well, he may hold by some sort of cycles of existence.
It could have started off like that.
It could be there's a cycle. I think he held by, I don't know, I didn't study Aristotle. I think he held by there's some sort of cycle of the universe's existence or some sort of something. Not exactly how it worked, but it's an eternal set of cycles. There's no creation according to him, right? There's no beginning. If that God exists eternally and the universe exists eternally.
How do you think metaphysical create something actually physical?
According to us or according to Aristotle?
How do you have something that just causes it without actually creating it?
Oh, well, I don't know. How do you have it creating it? Is your question really with the causing, or is it just the question with the... You know, the thing is that somehow, I don't know if he showed the mechanism, but because God's perfect, or something like that, and out of God's existence emerges these other existences. He's a cause. I mean, I don't know if it's clear how he creates it. We don't know exactly how he creates it either.
That's like the beauty of the Brihadas.
Yeah, I guess God's perfect, and emerging out of his perfection is the universe results from his existence. I don't know if he showed how exactly it operates, but I think he had a problem. I mean, the question is, he had a problem that God changes if he creates at one time at a different time or something. But I think that's what's saying. The first he showed is just saying is that God is the cause of all existence. Everything depends upon him. The second one is saying is that he created it. It means there was so to speak a moment where it doesn't have to exist. I guess that's the main point. It doesn't have to exist. It doesn't emerge from his existence, but it emerges from his action. He acted to bring it into existence.
It's not a description of God. Why? It is a description of God, but it's...
Well, it's closer to God. In Aristotle's way, the universe is closer to him, because it's almost, you couldn't conceive of God existing without the universe existing. So it's true, it's dependent upon him, but at the same time, it's more directly connected to him. According to us, God is Kadmo. He exists without anything else. His existence could be conceived of in the abstract without anything else. And then he happened to create, and the universe came about, and there's a beginning. Right? I mean, now we know, science, I don't feel there's a beginning, most science. Like the Big Bang, I don't know if Aristotle had a Big Bang exactly. I don't know. He had some sort of.
I'm saying he didn't have this.
No, what we have?
Yeah.
What, like a beginning?
No, I'm saying he didn't have on like the world of our Earth.
Right.
Like this, it just always was.
According to him?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know exactly how he had it. Maybe. I'm not sure.
Aristotle said this world always.
Right. There's some sort of cycles or whatever.
No, meaning like our Earth didn't evolve into like Earth.
I don't know. Maybe
he didn't hold evolution.
I'm not sure if he did or not.
Like what kind? Like yeah. I don't know.
Maybe is there a problem saying this exists?
No.
I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure, or he had some sort of, I think he had some sort of cycles, but I don't know exactly what type of cycles they are. So, but that's the first and the fourth. But I think the second one, I think they couldn't see, I think the point is, the question was, is the second one, once you say God is one, doesn't that mean he's not physical? Because that's his argument. If he's physical, then he has a body. I'm saying physically has parts, because everything physical has parts. But I think the answer is that the Yesodos are not, they're not independent philosophical theses as much as, like, these are the basics of what a Jew must believe to be a Jew. So he's not giving you the philosophical proofs. He's just saying, what does it mean to be a Jew? Because he holds, if you don't have the Yehudi Karm, you're not part of Klal Yisrael, there's no mitzvah to love you, there's, you know, all the mitzvah, the Rechem Lofa. It's like, Klal Yisrael is an ideological group. And what makes you part of the Torah is that you partake of the ideology. So what does the ideology maintain? Maintain that God is one. Maintain God doesn't have a body. Now, if you happen to go into it philosophically, you could derive one from the other. But that's not the point. It's, so to speak, a list of basic beliefs that a person has to have. So, like, if you believed that God was one, but you believed he had a body, is it logically consistent? No, but you don't have to know the proof. The point is, but still, that's a mistake. That's an independent mistake. And that would render you a kofer. You know? So it's like they're separate conclusions, even though they might be they're logically linked. Yeah, like, let's say, right. Yeah, let's even think about it. Right, you held that he's one, but you didn't think whether he had a body or not. Well, then you don't have the Yisod. The Yisod is that he doesn't have a body. That's like an independent conclusion. Right. That all the things we talk about, physicality and this and that, doesn't apply to God. That stuff doesn't apply to God. He doesn't have a body, he doesn't have a hand, he doesn't have a face, he doesn't have this, he doesn't have that. You know? Why is that so? Well, that kind of philosophically links in with Achdus. But that's a separate, his conclusion is separate, even though it might be linked. You know, so it could be if you have the proper idea of God as this cause of all existence, maybe you could derive that he's one. Yeah, that might be true. But even if that's true, that doesn't mean oneness isn't a separate conclusion. Like, these, so those are the conclusions, not the philosophical arguments for the positions. These, so those don't, you have to be a philosopher to be so to have the Yigibli Karma. The Karma, the conclusions that we maintain are true. How do you know they're true? That's a different discussion, but you have to know that they're true. This is what, if you want to be part of our group, we're an ideological unit. And if you have the Yikarim, then you're part of it. And if you don't have the Yikarim, you're not part of it. So what are the basics of the ideology? You don't believe every single thing in the Torah. A lot of different things in the Torah. You may not know every single conclusion to be part of the group, but certain things you do need to know. These are them. You know? Good? Yes?
Just elaborate on.
Yeah.
Turn on just for a second. It's a different point, but the book that I was reading brought this up. It basically said that, I mean, he sort of answered the question kind of like this, that the third one, that he doesn't have a body, is coming to show you not simply in a physical sense, but in any sort of spiritual or metaphysical sense. Because you can't say that God has any sort of form, so that
right.
Giving him metaphysical meaning is also incorrect.
I guess so. It depends what you mean by that. Like, I don't know what a metaphysical body.
I understand what that means. Like, people say, like, our spiritual, like an angel, like something like an angel, like people can think of it that way. So he said the Rambam had to add that because.
Oh, really? I don't know. Well, he says he's not a body, he's not a person in a body. Bodily things don't happen to him. But, I mean, if you're saying he has a metaphysical body, I mean, I think you're just confused more than anything. I don't know, what does that mean exactly, a metaphysical body? Or, you know? I don't know. It's just, that's not a body. I mean, if it's physical, it's not physical.
You're saying not to think, that you shouldn't think that there's some sort of spiritual form. Also. Like a malach or something like that.
But what is that? I don't even know what that means, a spiritual form. Like a malach. I mean, it's not like a malach, but that's the point. You know?
Totally clear what
yeah, mean. I don't know what that means. I mean, I understand. I think, I don't know. I don't know what that means exactly. He's not like a malach because of oneness or whatever, not because malach's physical. Malach doesn't have a physical form. Malach's not physical, but yeah, but he's not like a malach. But that's, I don't know if that's God. This he sort of says he's not physical. He's not a body. He doesn't have a body. He's not. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Okay. One question I had was, if God is one, then Nevi'im gave them like believability. Like, what made it so that Klal Yisrael at the time, like from Nevi'im, like Klal Yisrael a lot of things.
Right. So there's a halachas.
Like,
The Rambam has it in Hilchos Tzilia Torah. He says basically, a Navi, to verify him as a Navi, he has to predict certain events, very detailed predictions, and they have to come 100% true. To every last detail. He does it a few times until he's got enough evidence that there's no way he did it by chance. It has to be 100% true. It can't be like small details are off, because every psychic predicts things and they're a little bit off, you know? So he has to predict things, and they have to, like Navi says, it'll rain at this and this time, and the line will be due, it'll be on the wall at this point, or whatever.
Even like the slightest thing they can tell you.
Oh, well, it has to be enough that it's convincing. If they just tell you one thing.
Your watch is in... This
well, that doesn't prove that he's a Navi. I mean, they may tell you things like that, but it doesn't prove that they're a Navi necessarily.
I thought I had to tell you like three times. Something that you just don't know.
I don't think the Rambam says that. Maybe someone else.
And are these like things that were codified in the terms of Moshe Rabbeinu?
In what?
Like Moshe Rabbeinu didn't pass these.
Yeah, it's all also.
From like Moshe Rabbeinu.
I think so. I mean, I don't know. Okay. It's like any other halacha.
I'm saying like the Rambam came much later. I'm saying are these like halachas that were established?
It's like any halachas. I don't know. You learn it. What's sugi doing? And I don't know. Whatever. Any sugi in Bava Kamma? Is that from Moshe Rabbeinu, or is that like made up later? I mean, yeah, it's part of the Masorah.
Like, he's not just giving this as like.
No. It's a Masorah.
Right.
It's like a halacha. It's not a halacha. It's like Nebuah is a halacha. Mm-hmm. There's mitzvahs. There's part of a few mitzvahs in the Torah about a navi. And there are halachas about how exactly you verify him. Let me see.
So the Navi, though, would have to go through, like, before he was, like, give the advice that was necessary to the people, there was a verification process.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. Yes, definitely. You don't
just, like, no one
within. There are a lot of Nevi'i Sheker also. There are a lot of Nevi'i Sheker throughout our history. So you have to know how you're supposed to know whether he's telling the truth or not. Mm-hmm. That's halacha. There is a detail, though, is that if you predict something bad and it doesn't happen, then he's not rejected because he can tell you the tshuva. Kleisrael or whatever the tshuva. But if you predict something good, that's halacha. Even a good nivu always comes true.
Okay, but you're saying there was a verification process.
Definitely. Yes.
I'm hearing also that it has nothing really to do with what they predict. Because you can have two guys that predict the same thing, same three things, or different three things, but all those predictions are correct, and one will become a Navi Sheker, and one will become a Navi. Because the Navi Sheker, at the end, will tell you to violate, you know, don't...
It's another way, if he tells you to violate the Torah.
So, like, I thought, like, I'm sorry, I remember my uncle telling me, like, you see, that has nothing really to do with what they predict.
Well, there's different ways to become a Navi Sheker. Well, should we do the Rambam?
Yeah.
Okay. This is in Paragasiri in Isaiah Torah. So I'll just say the English about, okay? He says, any Navi who comes and says Hashem sent him, he doesn't have to do a miracle like Moshe Rabbeinu did, like Eliyahu or Elisha did, to change the law's nature. But rather, he says things are going to happen, and they'll verify it. And he quotes a pasuk, therefore, when a person comes who's fit for Nevuah, with Mal in Lachas Hashem, apparently there's prerequisites, he has to be like a Chacham or whatever. And he's not come.
What?
He has to have the prerequisites. He's a chacham. There's various things or whatever. He doesn't say right here, but he says somewhere else, I think.
Right.
And he doesn't come to add or to subtract from the Torah, nor to violate any of the mitzvahs. We don't say to him, split the sea or do tchias ameisim, but rather we say to him, if you're not, we tell us things are going to happen in the future, and we wait to see if they happen or not. And if even if one small thing comes not true, then he's Navi Sheker. And if they all come true, then he's believed. And we check him Pamim Harbe many times. And if all of his words come true, then he's Navi Emes. Like it says by Shmuel, come in! Come in! Well, maybe at least he'll lock it. Yeah. Top lock. Hey, Tamar.
Hi.
How's it going? Come on in.
Hey.
Yeah, so as he says, the Shmuel, they all knew from Dan to Beer Sheva that he was an Avi Hashem. He says, the Ma'onim and Kosim, they also predict the future. What's the difference? He says, no, because some of them come true, some of the things come true, some don't come true. But an Avi is totally true. Yeah.
So, from what I understand, the Navi wasn't like, didn't like always discuss things like that. You know, it was a certain
time,
times where right. God would talk to him or give it through some sort of dream or some sort of like, it's a thing that he had to kind of interpret.
Right.
But, so how was it that like the Navi was simply just able to predict these future events?
Oh, I guess God told
him. Did
them.
God tell him these? Yeah. These things tell them these things, and awesome this is what way. You'll use to verify?
No, because you can have a Navi check in them.
And then what?
Because you can have a guy who predicts three things, then he
it doesn't say three things, by the way.
You can have a guy that tells you, isn't this going to happen? But at the end, he tells you to, don't do tone anymore.
Oh, I understand. Well, that could be two things. I mean, first of all, the guy could have gotten lucky that he predicted things properly.
Right.
So then, but he's saying Navi MS. How's Navi MS?
No, because the Navi MS, because that same guy, that's what I'm trying to go back for him. That guy can also be lucky. But at the same time, since he just has this chazaka, that since he was able to tell you these three things, and he didn't tell you to violate or go against the Torah, we believe him.
Right.
But it has nothing to do with actually what he predicted.
Well, the assumption is.
It has to do with.
The guy wouldn't be able to.
No, but if the halacha is. That a Navi, like the Torah said, really, is that God does tell people things. And he sets up a method by which you can verify whether or not God spoke to them. The method is, he's going to predict them. And how is he supposed to predict them? Not because he's a good guesser, but because God tells him.
Right. So then you're saying the other guy is a good guesser?
Yes.
So why is this not guy got a good guesser as well?
Oh, so that's the answer. That the Ram says that the mitzvah is to listen to a Navi if he's verified.
Right. But it has nothing to do with what he said.
It's not that it has nothing to do with it. It's just that it's not 100% the proof. It's not, it's not 100% the proof that it's not a guess. But it's a good enough proof that it's a very good proof. And it's the mitzvah says that we have to listen to. But at the same time, that's a different point. That's an interesting point you're talking about, but that's not what he's asking.
Right. So, meaning if he does get all of the things right, the verification process, he passes, but then he says, don't keep Shabbos anymore.
Then it's one of two possibilities. Either he was guessing, and he just got lucky, and then we see that he's an Avi Shaker, or maybe he did B'chir B'chir Bara. Maybe he was an Avi, but he became a bad person. So there's an idea of an Avi could be a person could change, Even a person, an Avi, could become a Rasha. I don't think there's a person who's immune once they're an Avi that they can't become a Rasha. But then they're an Avi Shaka. They're still going on the thing of an Avi. Obviously, God didn't tell him that. Because God's saying he's Mitsumi forever and he's never telling an Avi to change the Torah. So if he does do that, then he's an Avi Shaka. He's saying things which God didn't tell him. And then we kill him. Right? But I think that, how is he supposed to know those things in the first place? Which is what God's telling him. Now, even though a Navi sometimes gets a Nevuah, but God's saying he's going to supply a Navi with evidence to be able to, right? That's like when Shmuel and Shaul came to Shmuel, he told him where his donkeys were, he knew Hashem told him the day before that he's going to come to him, and whatever. So, presumably God's going to tell him. Good?
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Next? Question? Got less there. Where are you going?
No, actually.
Okay.
Okay, so.
Come on in! Thanks.
I had another question on the tefillah on Shabbos. So, why.
You got it?
Yeah.
If you want, you can hang out with them. Hey there!
It's gone.
Welcome. You could put your code, whatever. You could put hang it on there if you want. Yeah.
So why is it like, I was just like taking like a quick look at like the tefillah like on Shabbos.
The room and get a chair is also if you want, but it's good.
Why by Marv, Shachar, and Mincha, all the tefillahs are different.
Right. Why is that true?
Yeah, like, no other, even on Yom Tovim, it's the same. Mm-hmm. And this, obviously during the week, but, like, And it's not like there's specific ideas that are particular to
Maharaj Chakra Samhita.
It's just like there's three things.
Right, random things.
Three random things.
Right.
So.
And what's Musaf also, right?
Yeah,
Musaf. I mean, I guess in Yantif you have a bigger Musaf, but that makes sense because you're talking about the current Musaf. But the Kanta Shabbos or whatever isn't
right,
exactly
like why, Musaf. Why or what? If they're all important ideas, why not have all three of them in one feeling?
What are you trying to do, dog?
No problem about that.
Was there a reason that they were broken up into three different things and divided amongst the day?
Good question. I don't know. I mean, the final bracha is the bracha is the same. The Elokeinu Kevod Hashem.
Right.
I mean, that's really the bracha,
right.
But it seems
right,
like
there's one main bracha of Shabbos,
but on Yantif, the lead-in stuff is all the same, and all the
it's all the same.
I don't know, that's a good point. It's, I don't know, it seems like there are various. It would be interesting to study them. I guess to really do it, you have to study each of them and see the themes. But it could be there are different themes in Shabbos. There's like a lot of different ideas. And for a reason, I don't know, maybe they wanted to break out the separate themes, and by doing so, they took each one of the tefillos and focused on a different one, different, you know? Now, why do you do them all at the same time? I don't know, maybe it'll be a much longer Shabbos, right? It's not necessary. The main bracha is the bracha, and you discuss various ideas in each one. But I mean, I'm just guessing. I mean, I would think that to really do it, I guess it would be nice to analyze each one and just try to, you know. One time I did chakras, I think. Analyze.
Shabbos
chakras, yeah. I think I went through it with my brother. But, you know, I don't know why we did that and didn't do Amara. I don't remember doing Amara and Mincha and Musaf. So.
The question is, why is the tefillah for Shabbos different for Mincha and Amara?
Yeah. All, why they're all different?
I don't know the source for this, and I didn't understand. When I looked at it, I didn't understand. But I asked this question once to someone, and told me that the different Shemoneh Esrei have a language of masculine, feminine, plural.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's true. I don't know if what that means. But,
uh-huh. Why? I think there's like one line there where he said that you should rest in it, and it, in him, in har, and it.
Well, that's actually within the bracha itself.
I know that's in the bracha itself.
So it's true.
That's in Elokeinu, okay, it's the same part. But is that? Do you remember though? Is that in the whole thing, or is it just in that line, or you know? Uh-huh. I don't know. That's a good question. I'd have to, it'd be a nice thing to do. But I've never done it. We could try to do it, but I don't know.
Do they all come from, like, a Gemara?
I don't know. It's a good question. Like, what was part of the Anshei Knesset Gedolah's original Takana? Is that all part of the Takana, or is that, like, a later thing? Question. What is the Denom have? I assume he does.
Also, one with the Prakashas. Prakashas were taken out much later, weren't they?
And taken out? I think that was early. You know, it's because it's like against
the Gemara.
I don't think the Gemara has seven brachos, I think so, because it says it's like, you know, and be involved in the Eretz Racham on Shabbos. I think so.
Yeah. You don't want to be involved in what?
Like your physical Tzrachim, like your Malacha Tzrachim, your needs of the world. Shabbos, you're just involved in, like, ideas and.
Yeah, because they have, let's say, like, you missed, like Friday Mincha.
Right.
Like, you said two, you know, Shabbos, Mars.
Yeah, right, they have it. It's definitely the Gemara. Yeah, I think it's early. I think the Ram has them also. He has what we have. Yeah. I mean,
still it's main. The reason why they take out the Brachot, that middle part, is not solely because of the Takana we have now of not having Brachot. Anyway, there's a separate thing on Shabbos that we don't do percussions, correct?
Yes.
So, but that's seemingly the middle part of Shemoneh Esrei was taken out for, even though there's a percussions, they're taken out earlier than that.
Percussions was always an idea.
The percussions were taken out because of like some sort of like
some
during the.
Ask for
they were taken out because of like some sort of the Brahmins or something, some sort of.
No.
And then they didn't want to be reminded of like.
I don't know.
Like, During some sort of during some war or whatever, where like in asking for things like stirred up some sort of like sadness, and like you didn't want to have sadness on your toes, so that's like any closer percussions.
I don't know if that's true. I never heard that. I don't know.
We asked this question on earlier this year.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. I don't know. Really? I don't know. Yeah, so I'm just looking at the tefillah. So I do see is Atak Yidashta. Like on Friday night, we're dealing with like when Shabbos is entering. It's like the Kedusha Shabbos, the transition from Kol to Shabbos. And the tefillah is somehow about like the Kedusha Siyama Shabbos. So maybe it's like at that point, you're talking about how Hashem's Mekadei Shabbos. So as you're entering Shabbos, that's like, that's what you say. Then on Shabbos day, it's like, you're talking about like Moshe's the Simcha of Shabbos, maybe like talking about the good features of Shabbos as an oath between God and Klal Yisrael. You know, like maybe there's like Friday night you're mentioning the entering Shabbos and therefore focusing on what, that aspect, and then on like a Shabbos day it's like you're in the thick of Shabbos talking about the good features of what Shabbos is. Like this transition, and there's, you know, and I don't know, then my Musaf is just Musaf, they're going to mention the Karb Musaf. And I don't know what this mecha is. Atayach,
yeah, how does
it work that you can burn a korban on Shabbos?
Burn a korban on Shabbos? The avodah sayam is docha Shabbos. The ones which have to be on that day.
Doesn't make any sense, though.
Doesn't make sense.
How can you do malacha?
Whole
idea is that you can't do
malacha. It's true. But those things which are part, it's like,
good question.
Malachas are like, you see all the things that took place in the basement. So that's kind of contradictory,
you're saying.
Right, arguably, it's like there's an idea of the avodah sayom. So the idea of malacha takes you away from the yom. It's the yom of the idea of Shabbos. But this is the avodah sayom. This is the way we serve God on this day. So it's not taking you away from the...
Not just kabbalahs, meaning all the avodahs of the day.
The things which couldn't be done on any other day. If it's fixed in its times, so the Torah is specifically saying, this is how you serve God on this day. Are you going to say, but does that take you away from... I mean, it's docha Shabbos. I don't think it's Shabbos. It's not malacha. What it's just saying is that God deemed, and it's a question of what's going to take precedence, but God deemed that we serve God, and we serve God every day of the year, not only on weekdays, but even on Shabbos. The way we serve God on Shabbos is by the Korbanos of Shabbos, and this is the appropriate Korbanos which are serving God on Shabbos, thinking about the ideas tied to Shabbos. And if you, it's Docha Shabbos, it is Malacha, but we have a conflict. On the one hand, Malacha Shabbos is about rest, and not Malacha. On the other hand, Shabbos is about serving God. That saying is, there's the lima that says that that's like the things which have to be done on that day take precedence and push aside malacha. But it is a clash. I don't think he's saying it's not malacha. It is malacha, but there's like a pecking order, so to speak. Like you do bris milah on Shabbos, certain things are do push aside Shabbos. So malacha on Shabbos. You know, there's like a conflict of values, and you have to have an order of what takes precedence over what. So. Like, we don't build the Mishkan on Shabbos. We build the Mishkan after Shabbos. But you can't say, do the Korbanos of Shabbos during the week. They're not going to serve God on Shabbos. But the idea of Malacha is it like takes you away from thinking about God as the Creator. But it's saying this is you doing the Korbanos as an expression of recognition of God as the Creator, you know? So that if you wouldn't do that, basically the only way you recognize God on Shabbos is like passive. Positive, like we have positive actions to recognize God as the Creator, which is bringing Korbanos. So if you wouldn't have Korbanos on Shabbos, then your whole recognizing God on Shabbos would be through like cessation, which is part of how Shabbos works, but the Torah also has a positive program for Shabbos.
Which doesn't just include the special Korban for Shabbos, you do the Tamid.
You do Tamid, right. And then you also do Korbanos, right.
Right. You
have
to explain for both.
Yes, that's true. But I mean, I think the general thing is things which are fixed and have to be in that day, we don't put the avodah which has to be done on that day. So the Talmud is every single day. So now, If you wouldn't have it, basically you'd say the Tamid is not Tamid.
Right.
So then it'd have to be, you know. So in order that's... Well, now you could have said, look, Shabbat is more important than the Tamid, but apparently it's not. Right? It's a Kohen Tamid, so that's the idea where Tamid over Hashem. But I mean, it's a good point that Shabbat, even Shabbat, as important as it is, isn't the only absolute... Is that the door?
What's the door?
Oh, that's probably Shmuley's rolling around.
I feel like a pasuk in the Torah that's the Gemara says like the most pasuk, the most important pasuk in the Torah is the pasuk that says you have to bring the carpet on every day.
Oh, you know what? There is a thing like that. It just doesn't. Yeah, it says. I think someone just told me this. Who just told me? I don't know. It says, "Amar v'alter kmocha zeh kol gadol b'Torah." Right. You know that? It's like over here said, after Moshe Zekalotar. The other mandama, I think, says it's Zekalotar, something like that. Like it's the other sheet that holds that. It's like not, it's less famous, but I mean, that's the other.
It doesn't lend itself to as good as a song.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, among other things. That's true. Yeah, so I don't know. I was just getting working there in the beginning of the brachos, but it's a good question. The shav, you know, the different feels. And in Yandavi, you don't have that. Good question. I don't know. I've never thought about it before, but it's, I like the question. But I think it would need. That would be my idea. It would be to try to go through each of them, figure out what the ideas in each of them are, and to, you know, see if there are themes in each of them, and then see if they are appropriate to their times. And I don't mind, like, the question about why Yontif doesn't bother me that much. I mean, it's interesting that it doesn't, but whatever, I don't know.
Right.
And the fact that like, it could be if there are various different ideas about Shabbos, and it does seem there is a thing of having a short davening. I think there is a thing of short davening on Shabbos. I think that's is a thing more like that specifically.
I think so.
I don't know. I forget why. Maybe it's a thing like that. But I don't know. You could say it's like there's an idea of focusing on the different facets of Shabbos, and sometimes one approach is to stuff everything together, but another approach is to separate them apart. This way you could appreciate them on their own. So it could be, given their different tefillahs and their different ideas of Shabbos, so the Torah chazal saw a fit to separate them off. And there's no din that tefillahs have to be exactly identical. I mean, the essence, central bracha is identical, but the lead-in, you know, which is just an elaboration on different ideas, so it could be they relegated certain ideas to different tefillahs, which exist on Shabbos. But, I mean, I'm kind of sketching out an approach. You know, you have to see the particulars. But you have to go.
Yeah,
okay. Okay.
Not to kill the idea.
It's already killed. Okay, see you, Jay. Yeah. Okay, good?
Yeah, that's good.
Okay. Devin? Yeah. The new guy always asks a question.
Okay. I don't know a lot of the specifics. I've heard that a long time ago, and it's reminding me of today. The whole time period where the Torah was lost except for like one person found it. You know what you're referring to? Something in Nath?
Yeah.
I forget which king.
Yeshiah?
Yeah. So with that story, people always ask, well, how can you know it's proof of Sinai if there was a missing link?
Right. Right. Yeah, I have to look into that story. It's a good question. But I've heard the answer. I mean, I have to check it out, or really, like, maybe I should look into it more deeply. But it seems like the this is what I saw someone answer. I think it's a good answer, but I can't prove that it's true. What it's saying is like the didn't have the Torah. The Torah was like kind of taken away. The public, when they saw the public, and even the king, and he saw the Torah, it was like shocking, and he saw and what it said, and he realized we didn't do the Torah, and it was like a big thing, you know. He decided to wipe out the Zara, and he was moved by finding the Torah. But he wanted to argue that there were Nevi'im in that time. I mean, that's, I think, that was the argument. I think Josh Maruf said this, that there were Nevi'im going around in that time, and Navi has to be, you know, Torah, gold. So there was an underground Zara of the Chachamim, but there was a society as a whole was corrupt, and there was a lot of like a bazaar going on and whatever. And you see, you do see that there were bad bad false Nevi'im who would kill the kings, like Ahav and Isabel, well, they would kill like Nevi'im. So there was an underground Mesora, which was maintained. It's just that it wasn't in the public because there was, the public was corrupt and evil. And so, but the fact that there were Nevi'im at that time, and a Navi has to be very knowledgeable in Torah, so obviously they knew the Torah. How would they be Nevi'im if they didn't have Torah? So just saying is that the on the public arena, and the king was in the public sphere, and there were either corrupt kings, and there were evil kings, and there were, you know, so that's what they didn't know. But not that the Mesorah was lost, it's just that the everyday Jew didn't have the Torah, you know what I mean? But there was still, the Torah was still present throughout, you know, the chum of the, you know, of the Torah. But, you know, I'm just saying that. I guess it would be good to verify that more, you know, to prove that that's the case. And that was his argument, though, that there were, I mean, knowing that era, there were, I forget how many, you know, I don't know the history of it, but I think he did. He had a few Nevi'im who were, like, walking around at that time.
If you say that that's true, is that enough? Originally, the whole idea was that there was a million people there. Now you have a handful of Nevi'im.
Yeah. That's a good question. Yeah, you mean if you just have, does it all basically just come? Maybe he, there's like, whatever, let's say there's 10, 20, 30, whatever. Maybe they just made up the Torah. They just said, here's this book, and everyone else, you never heard of it. You mean like the whole chain is only as strong as the amount of people you have in any one given generation. Right, so you're saying maybe they just came and wrote this book, didn't really exist, they just came and told everybody, oh, your forefathers had this thing, and oh, you never heard of it. But we were telling you it happened, and you just sold everyone, but like, oh, that it happened. And they're like, well, you didn't have a Torah. Oh, yeah, you have a Torah, because you guys are all doing with the Torah and whatever, but here it is, take a look. And it says in here that God appeared to your forefathers. Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure if the idea of Torah or the idea of God, I don't know. I never really looked into that, Larry. It's a good question. It's shaykh to do. I know that's a classic question.
Okay.
Yes.
Is it good time for a new question?
Not yet. I don't think so. I'm not sure. I'll tell you
okay.
What it is, okay?
Okay.
Like, I've never heard the story before.
Okay.
Probably,
the story is, I don't know exactly the details, but I haven't looked at it recently, but there was a King Yoshio.
Right.
He was little. Young kid, you know, started when he was young. And I think, basically, he was, one day, they, like, found the Torah. And they read it, and it said, and they had, like, oh, you're supposed to do Sukkot, or I don't know, I forget exactly how it went. But then they were shocked. Whoa, Torah, really? This is what the Torah says? And he decided to like make a campaign of wiping out of the Torah, and you know. But it sounded like he and the people were like kind of ignorant of what the Torah was about.
Well, why do you feel like that Torah
would apply to them? Oh, that's you mean why they think it's for their Torah? I guess they knew they were the Jewish people.
They had something.
I know, that's a question. That's a good question. I mean, that's a question. It sounds like they must have known, maybe they didn't have the book, but they had the fact that they knew that there was a Torah. Otherwise, yeah, what is it?
Right.
Yeah, right. Maybe it's not even us or whatever.
Of course.
You're right. It could be they didn't, it was some book which they didn't know about, but they knew. If it says, the question is, if they had never ever heard that there was a revelation in Sinai, God spoke to people, all of a sudden they just find the book which says in it, oh, God spoke to your forefathers in Sinai. Question is, would people believe such a thing? Like, you can tell me, really? That's what the book says? I never heard of this. I mean, it could be that's what we'll get the same argument on Messina. Where is it? It's in Malachim Beis.
Malachim Beis?
I'm not sure. But I think Malachim Beis. Yoshiyahu, which is impossible to spell. With an Aleph.
You also have like this state.
It's a good point though, right? And would they accept, would they argue, maybe you could pull the same argument. Would people accept that book, assuming they never heard of such a thing, Are you basically coming and providing them with a book which says that your forefathers, a million of them, saw this event and never ever heard of it? So arguably, the fact they accepted it means they heard of that. Now, it may not be they knew the exact text or whatever.
I mean, these are people that are worshipping idols now. So, like...
But still they accepted it.
Yeah, I'm saying, like, oh, my idol's really not doing much for me. Maybe let's try this.
Well, that's the argument to Armisina. The question is, are you going to be able to convince a million people, the people that their million forefathers saw, heard God speak to them? And they're not going to throw it out and say, maybe you'll try to do it, but we're not going to accept the book which claims that your forefathers heard mass revelation. You could do that, then try to do that now and start a new religion by pulling out a book that says that. You know, but then you're going to have to say, you're going to tell people that this thing happened, which they never ever heard of before. Never happened. Right? And they're not going to believe it. So they didn't have the book. Yeah, but the event which happened, the fact that they accepted the book, must be they knew about the event, although they may not have had the exact book.
Also, just because they have the book, don't we always say that the book is not complete without Torah Shebaal Peh? And if all they had was a book, then it was Torah Shebaal Peh lost?
No, well, that's what I'm saying, is that for that you can have the Chacham, however many there are, and again, hiding or whatever, the Masorah can be maintained. The question, though, is the veracity of the Torah, the argument of Torah from Sinai, that there was this event, and that we have a Torah from Sinai, that this event happened, is what this arguably calls into question. You know, so if you say that that was the case, now the question, where was the Masorah? So then you can say from the Nevi'im, the Masorah anyways is maintained through the Tamid Chacham, and the Masorah of Torah Shebaal Peh is not maintained necessarily through the masses, it's maintained through the Tamid Chacham. So argue with the Chum were there, just like they were always there. You know, the small groups, the Tamid Chum and the Beis Medrash. There's no evidence that they were lacking in that, though. It just means that the political regime didn't know about it.
Also, maybe in terms of, like, nowadays,
yeah.
It's been 3,000 years since Sinai, so, like, really, I feel like it's definitely true, you know, but if you're only validating the event that happened,
Right. So you mean it could be they just all knew about it. They knew the event happened.
More likely than thousands.
Right. I understand. Right. I understand. I mean, they had it in their collective memory. Right. You're a few generations removed from it. So then they wouldn't have. And also, they'd be more likely to sort of reject it immediately if they never had such a thing in their consciousness. Tell me, like, whatever, 100 years ago, I don't know how many it was, this thing happened, they never heard of this. I mean, they did. Now, they didn't have the book. Fine, they didn't have the book because there was an idolatry going on and it wasn't in the public eye. Yeah. But it would be a shayach to learn through the, you know, historical context of what was going on in Kaish at the time and get a sense. Because it is a question that people, you know, use to attack the Torah. I've seen people do it. I've seen this Josh Maruf tries to defend it. He does a decent job, but... Josh Maruf? Yeah, he's the media shiva. So I saw online some debate that he had with somebody with this thing. But it's shaykh to go through it. Maybe I'll go through it one time. Good question. Thanks.
On the same line?
Yeah.
Maybe a quick question, but the Torah Shebaal Peh, does that fall under the same proof of Sinai?
Good question. I just went through this recently. There's a tape where he takes that out. It's in the fundamentals, I think.
Why do you think that?
What?
Because
there are smaller people in that
generation.
Right, and as well as, like, the Torah itself contains, you know, the fact that it was given in front of
The masses.
Which was also only contained amongst a group of people, so how does it, how do you know the truth in it? The same way, so, you know.
Right. I forgot, I went through this recently. I forgot what we came to, it was a long discussion.
What's even more difficult is that it doesn't say anywhere in Torah itself anything about Torah.
Well, it does. That's part of what it does say.
It does?
It says that if you have any question about any halacha, then you have to go to the Beis Din of your door and ask them the question.
But again, that doesn't say explicitly that there's a whole other system of laws.
Well, I mean, it says if you have a question about a din or about a nega or about a thing, then you have to go. go to the Chacham of your door to be able to find out the answer. So, and you don't say, just read the book. In the book itself, it tells you how you resolve questions and how are they supposed to know. So they know because there's an explanation given along with the thing. And I think it's implicit in the book itself that there's many things which are not explained. It's like, it's a tot tefillin, it's a tot tafel, it's like, what does that even mean? There are things in the Torah which are clearly meant to be in the Kavanah, you know, there's a commentary which goes along with them. Where there's another example where it says, by Shechita, it says, Yishachte kasher tzivisicha, like I commanded you to do it. But it never says anywhere in the Torah, Shvazav, how to do it. Yeah, I mean, but it does, it's not, you know, there's arguably different ways to interpret that, these things. You know, if you just have the book itself, maybe you could. There's other ways to try to, I don't know, it's a good question. I have to revisit what the hell what we resolved on that.
The question, how does Sinai prove situation like that?
Yeah, right,
I mean, we understand how, you know, Sinai can prove Torah Mitzvah, because that's also, it's expressed through, it was given to a mass of people, but that's one aspect, and versus Torah Shavuot, which is only a certain small group has it. It's not like, especially back then, that was only such a lot of us, but
had to be deceptive.
It says like this, is that if something is a matter of judgment that's hidden from you, bin dam ledam, whether it's a matter of a kind of a blood, I guess with some or not, bin din ledin, so din, bin negal nega, some plague, divrei rivas v'sharacha, some arguments in your gates, you come up to the Yerushalayim, you go to the Kohan Leviim, the Shofet in your time. If they're rushed, then you'll ask him, and I'll tell you. You have to do according to how he tells you. You do like he told you. According to the Torah, she teaches you, and the Mishpat that he tells you, you have to do. Can't turn away, right or left. And if you do, then he basically talks about, you know, what's it called, the Zaken Mamre, that you kill a person if you violate, turn away from the... I mean, so the thing is, when you have any question in the Torah, you have to go to the Shoftim, to the Chum of the door. And each door, there's going to be ones, and they're going to tell you what it is, and you have to, the halach is, you have to go according to them. So you see that the way the system was designed to be followed was based upon going to the Chacham. Now how the Chacham deciding, so that's through their interpretation of the Torah, which is through Torah Shabbat. So, I mean, it doesn't say, if you have a question, just read the Torah very carefully, and, you know, see what it says. But rather, it says there's a system of the Bayu Chacham, and the Chacham say that it's through Masorah, through Halacha.
So if you wanted to prove to someone who would, let's say, completely disconnected the truth of the Talmud, so you just have to tell them that there was a system out, you know, that the Chum contained that was separately passed through them?
I think so. You'd have to, I don't know if you're going to convince them with this exactly. You'd have to... I don't know. I think you'd have to show, first of all, that the Torah is not really interpretable without a tradition about what it means. It wasn't meant to be a complete book. From maybe this pasuk, it's different. I think the Sefer Chinuch has a few. The Sefer Chinuch does a good job. If you ever want to read, good read, then show the Sefer Chinuch. Did someone tell me they ever started reading that? It's excellent. He has Torah Messina. He talks with Torah Shabbat Pah. He has proofs showing you why Torah Shabbat Pah, Torah Shabbat Sav cannot be complete on its own. Like not a book that's meant to be followed on its own. They tell you all kinds of things without a lot of details missing. There's no way it could be meant to be, you know, followed without picture that, and so really goes along with it. So I think that's what you'd have to first establish. I mean, you have to. You'd have to do it, but if you actually were arguing with somebody like that, I think that'd be the first step, is to show the Torah is meant to be Misorah, you know, to be interpreted with Torah Shema Pa. And then you see that that's the way God designed it. I mean, as that scene, I used to set up a system which just has various heavy intents in details, and tells you when you have questions on the details, you go to the body of the Chachamim who are set up in each and every door. So now, that's the argument, is that he's telling them how to interpret it, and that's each and every door. We have Chachamim who are the ones who are passing down that tradition. That tradition was designed by God to be passed down to the Chacham.
I mean, another difficulty I was having was that, as well, like, even the bigger question when you brought that up was, like, if there was a point in time where there were very few people, so did those few people themselves have knowledge of all of Talmud and all of Torah Shabbat Peh, that they were the ones that were passing down Torah Shabbat Peh? Torah Shabbat Tzav, I mean, that's written down, they can pass it down.
Right. Yeah,
but it seems like there are points in time where, if it wasn't written down at that point, so how were things kept intact?
They memorized them. They spent their people who gave their lives. There were the groups of Bali Misora throughout all the generations who memorized. That's why they ever made a big deal about memorizing Mishnayos and learning. There are the groups of Bali Misora throughout the generation. Yeah, we have a chain. Goes back all the generations. And yeah, they were great, great minds. I don't know how many of them there were, but yeah, they were masters. And like Rambam was a master in all social path. You know, so there were people who were before him were greater than him, had greater minds, you know. Greater as great. And there were groups of them. Where you see the Tanama and Rambam in every page of Gemara. And you see Rav, Shmuel, Abaye, Rava, I mean, they're everywhere. So yeah, they were the ones who were, you know, Rabbi Yonasi wrote all the Mishnah, so that's not all the Mishnah. The Mishnah is written by Rabbi Yonasi. You see the same names. Rabbi Meir is in the Mishnah everywhere. And one Sechta doesn't have Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, you know. But yeah, they were in, you know, holding in all these different areas. I don't know exactly how many people, whatever, but yeah, you see the same names are appearing throughout Shas. Yeah, and they were most of their nefesh to maintain that system. The one time I heard someone say is interesting. It's a good point. Interesting way to look at it is like, in the last 100 years, you've had like the world's greatest minds are like Nobel Prize winners, Jewish Nobel Prize winners in like physics and all that. You know, like you just look back, it's like you go down the list of all these. Now all those minds were in Torah. You know, like there were Jews were. There's the idea of like a secular Jew is like a more of a modern invention, but like the great talent who are working out the world's, you know, greatest theories in physics and all that, or you know, in psychology, you know, I mean, just the greatest minds, all the Jews are to the limit, the proportion, I'm sure you've seen it, the proportion of Nobel Prizes in physics, or, you know, in Jews versus non-Jews, it's like ridiculous proportions, but these greatest minds were used to be directed towards Chachma, towards Torah, so yeah, you had the greatest minds in the, out there, who are putting all their Yom Valayla from the time they were kids in terms of, you know, preserving, protecting, passing down, memorizing all the Masorah and all Torah Shema Peh. And that happened for generation, 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 all the way back. You know, and that's how God designed it to be maintained. And that's how it was maintained throughout all the generations. And every page of the Gemara, you see evidence of it, you know.
But two questions. One is the person who's winning the Nobel Prize, who might be called a secular Jew.
Right.
In his lifetime, and not necessarily even his father's, or honestly, his grandfather's lifetime, did they learn Gemara?
No.
So are we saying that like, something trickled down into him regardless?
Well, I'm making a different point. I'm just saying is the gene pool and the intelligence which exists in the Jewish nation, I'm saying was that it was a few generations back, all totally, you know, and going all the way back was entirely directed to Torah. So therefore, I'm saying it's like, you think of Bali Misora, you have to think of the world's like greatest geniuses.
Wait, who was sustaining this?
who were sustaining the system exactly. It wasn't just some like random people who were doing it. I'm saying is, the you see Jews are very smart, and you see that in the recent history, the smart, like, unfortunately, it is unfortunate, but the Jews are being secularized, and these great smart Jews are putting their talents into these areas, and you see how they're able to, you know, come up with the greatest ideas. So what I'm saying is that same gene pool is where they're coming from, going back, was directing their energies towards maintaining the Mesorah, towards learning Torah and passing it down. And it is, I think the point that this guy was saying is that when you think of the Bali Mesorah, you should be thinking of the Einsteins of the world. That's like what the Bali Mesorah were. They're not just schlumps, rabbis with whatever, beards and whatever. These are the greatest minds that the world has. And, you know, and they've been involved in Chachma their whole lives, and this is like this is what they are. You know, so that's who you should think about. But you're, I'm not saying that's what I'm saying. Your question is now going backwards. Is Torah responsible for them? So I'm just talking purely genetically. Right. But I mean, I think Einstein, there's a quote from Einstein. He said he's proud to be part of a heritage of people who value his knowledge for his own sake. So I think arguably the idea. The Jewish superego, or every Jewish mother, the valuation upon knowledge and in smart, the value of chachma is part of our culture, part of the way we're inbred, and like the Jew wants to know, what values knowledge for its own sake is something which I think comes down through the, you know, even if you're removed from Torah by a few generations, you know, like Einstein, I don't think his parents were from, maybe his grandparents, I don't really know. But he still had that sense. He knew that. But that's not really... But there's also the genes. It's just the genetics and the thing, you know. It could be a combination of both. It's the genetics and the value of knowledge, which is, you know.
But is that person, that great mind, right?
Mm-hmm.
More valuable, equally valuable, or totally separate than, like, you know, just the average simple-minded person who might not think much about anything, all he knows is that his father told him that his father told him that his father told him that this wasn't a lie. And like, that person's valuable because he's one of millions of people who say, oh yeah, I can verify that my family hasn't corrupted some sort of conspiracy.
Mm-hmm. Versus what? Versus like the Rambam, let's say?
Yeah, who...
More valuable in terms of what?
To maintaining... validity and accuracy of Torah Shulchan.
I mean, they both have different roles, but I mean, like you'd say, who's more valuable to America, George Washington or George Washington's, you know, butler?
Right.
I mean, they're both part of carrying on the American dream, but I mean, I would think George Washington is somehow more foundational and played a more significant role. But does that mean that every American isn't a part of what it means to be American? And of course, it's both. So I think it's like, yes, Klal Yisrael is built upon, it's a nation which has Talmid Chacham at the center, but at the same time, it's a nation. And it's not just like Avraham Avinu had individuals, it was a group of individual philosophers. But what God did at Sinai was he created an Am. And an Am has Talmid Chachamim and has the Am. Individuals who, yeah, like you're saying, passes down to their kids, and they do halacha, and they pass it down. That was, I think, the greatness of Torah was God set up that there's a Mesorah, every single person involved in Mesorah, simply by keeping halacha. And when you keep the halacha, the mitzvos are preserved, and the mitzvos themselves contain ideas, and then they're available to the next generation to be able to study the ideas from it. So it's like the Mesorah is passed down through great minds, but also through just your plain and the plain simple person who does the Torah mitzvahs, passes that down and teaches his kid the Torah mitzvahs, and then each mitzvah, the mitzvahs which you do, contain the idea. So it's like available for people to now look at a Jew and say, oh, eating kosher, a life of discipline and self-control, that's an interesting idea. Maybe there's an idea to that, you know? So plain keeping mitzvahs maintains that. So every Jew, on any level, is involved in that and plays a role in that. And without an Am, you wouldn't have Torah. Torah exists because it's a nation. Right? Avraham Avinu is on his own. That's, I think, that's at Sinai. Sinai was showing this is the way to make... The idea was Avraham's great, but ultimately Sinai is what's going to last. that's what God did at Sinai, was to create an Am. So everyone has their role, and they play a part in maintaining that. But, I mean, at the same time, I think you can't, the role is not identical. I mean, a Chacham, who is, again, like the example of George Washington or whatever, I mean, there were different, obviously, the ones who are actually passing down the highest ideas in the system and maintaining the core, you know, ideational content of it are playing a more central role. But that's, you know, different, you know, it's just the way of the world. There's different people, but they're all important. The system is designed that, like, a Kohen and Levi Yisrael is more important. I mean, the Torah has different roles. It's not a matter of important. They're all important. It's the nation has various components. It's like a business. I don't know, a business has a CEO, a CFO, a worker, a secretary. I mean, they're all part of a business. A good functioning business needs everybody to work. A good functioning business doesn't let people dwell on those kinds of questions. You know, it's not productive. You know, they're all important. Yeah. Good?
Okay. Can I ask a separate question?
Yeah. Oh, well, I think Ariel's on hold. Related to this or new question?
We're related to Sarah Sinan, but it's not so related to the previous end of conversation, so if he has a question.
Okay. So, hold on. Ariel? Still there, my man?
Yeah, I'm still here. So, I just want to know, as a Jewish nation, what is a better system of government? Is it a monarch one or a democratic system? Because I was just curious, because I know, like, in a time of Shaul, really we weren't supposed to have a king, and I mean, we were complaining that we wanted one and it wasn't the right time, but then, I know it didn't just turn out very well, but I was curious, you know, just in general,
what is a better system? Mm-hmm.
Good question.
What's the best form of government in this current era, I think? Like having a king or a democracy?
Can we discuss this once?
I don't know. Did I?
Isn't the kingship like...
Not optimal.
Most optimal and unideal.
Yeah, well, he's saying is it seems like the Jews didn't, like, they were criticized for wanting a king at some point, because you see, Shmuel would have been better to be under a Nabi.
Wasn't that
though
just the wrong time?
I don't know, was it? I mean, Torah has a mitzvah of a melech. The question is, why is they getting upset that they made us for a melech? It's in the parsha of the Torah to have a melech.
Right. I know. Like, the most ideal to have, like, the most intelligent person.
Right, I think so. I think that was Plato's thing as a philosopher king, right?
Yeah.
The idea is, in theory, that's a part of the problem, is that I think you need, the idea is to have a leader, the chacham, who could organize a society. Whether it's, look, if it's a king or if it's a shmuel, it's a navi, it's whatever, but the idea is having a great leader at the head of a nation who could organize the nation in an intelligent way is, I think, an ideal. It seems like Torah has that ideal of a leader, of a nasi, of a king. The problem is that that demands that he's a philosopher king, so to speak, that he's perfected. And I mean, that's why the Torah has many checks and balances on the king to make sure that he doesn't go overboard. I mean, a king is, in its nature, a corrupting type of position. It can make him arrogant. The Torah has checks on that. Right? All the different halachas the king carries around the Torah all the time. He's only allowed to have 18 wives.
Is the Torah with him?
Yeah. All the time. Yeah.
Figuratively?
I don't know. I think literally. I don't know if it's on his person or maybe. I don't know if he has to hold it in his hands all the time, but yeah, he has to have his own Torah that he always has.
Wow.
I don't know. That's a good question, but yeah, it's a mitzvah for him to always remember. The less he becomes arrogant. And there's different halachas, again, of course, so not the money. I mean, there's a lot of halachas specifically for a king. But I mean, Torah recognizes it's like a double-edged sword. I mean, you see, there are many corrupt kings throughout history.
That's my favorite mitzvah.
Which one?
You can't own too many horses.
Yeah.
It's your favorite mitzvah.
Okay.
Okay,
let's go.
Do you keep it?
Sure,
yeah. That does seem like the most ideal, having an intelligent
king. Yeah, it's the problem is, just, again, there are many corrupt kings throughout history. And it's dangerous. I mean, it's a danger.
Right.
But like
nowadays, probably not. Because
yeah, nowadays you need a.
The only way to have the most perfect king is through Nebula and through.
Yeah, right, right. I think given that we don't have that, like the system of checks and balances is a good idea of different forms of government. Yeah, democracy, and you have different, you know, the idea of a balance of powers is a good idea this way. Any one person is prevented from being too powerful. That's important because you don't have perfected people at the helm. So, you know, so I say, yeah, in a society which is not governed by the Torah and doesn't have the whole system of Torah mitzvahs in place, it would seem you don't want to have one person in charge. That's going to be very dangerous. But in an ultimate society, I guess the Torah is designed the ultimate society, it seems to be it's better to have one person because he's going to be able to, you know, someone has to make all the shots and organize and decide, and if the greatest Chacham could do it, he could, you know, delegate as is appropriate, but at the same time he's in charge. Ariel?
Yeah.
Sounds good?
Yeah, it's good. So basically it's just dependent on the time and the status of the Jewish people. I mean, like, now we can't have it because we don't have a Navi and
right.
We don't have anyone at that level to be capable of a responsible king, I guess.
Yeah, and, right, exactly. Yeah. Right, exactly, right. Right. You can't trust the person who's going to do that, but the Torah system has a person to do it. You could trust.
Right. So I guess just a follow-up question. How come we weren't ready for a king, you know, after Moshe Rabbeinu, or maybe like right after Yeshua, and how come we weren't ready for that?
I don't know, that's a good question. I mean, why did we somehow go to Shoftim and then Navi and...
Right.
I don't know. It's a good question. Why didn't we just straight away? I mean, they saved the Moshe out of the Din of Melech. I think Yeshua had a Din of Melech. But I don't know what happened after that. Like, why wasn't it just continuous? Malach, I don't know. I know, it seemed like there was somehow a break until we went into that system. I don't know.
Well, it seems like at the beginning of the year was your governing law was the halachos.
Right. It's true. Right.
So, I mean, you didn't need a king.
No, but still, you might need someone to fight the wars and to... I mean, you know, halachos, but there's also, I mean, the king is part of the system, like certain mishpat gets accomplished by a melech, like a bezin works together with the melech, and I don't know. It's a good question. I don't know. It's a good question. I once looked into this years ago. I did this with Rabbi Ginsburg, I remember we went through, mm-hmm. On a camping trip. I remember we went through the whole parsha of melech.
Isn't the Kohen Gadol also looked at as some, like, figure, but as in like not a king, close to some leader.
He's a leader, I think, in Avodah. Avodah is the base of Mikdash. I mean, there's also a Kohen for a war. They call him Mashiach Muhammad. But I don't know. I don't think he's a king. I mean, there is a somewhat of a division of power. There's three crowns. That's what that's what I'm asked. So the Mishnavos, I think. It's the crown of Kuhuna, crown of Malucha, and a crown of Torah. So we have the like Rosh Yeshiva, they have the king, and we have the Kohen Gadol. They're different types of authorities, different roles assigned to each of them.
What were the previous systems that we had before the Malucha?
You had Shoftim. They judged the people, they were Chachamim, and they judged them, and they were somehow brought into war, but I don't know, it wasn't in the Din of Melech, I don't think.
But it was just a group of...
No, there was always an individual guy, or girl, at the time, who was did it. But I don't know what his status was, I don't think they had a status of a Melech. And then there was like a Navi, like Shmuel was the Navi who led them. I was always upset that they asked for cake. One of the pshatim is they ask for a king like all the nations that are around us. So it's like they were moved by, they should have been happy to have a Navi who was leading them. Like, so the person like Shmuel, they didn't need a king. But like, what's the difference? Why wasn't Shmuel a king? That's the question. Like, why not? Why wasn't Shmuel just a king? Let him be a king.
Well, like, seemingly the king is like, title is just a technicality.
You know, but I think a king also has like a certain type of a power over the people, which is not really necessary. sounds like that's what I'm saying, is people could organize under the tutelage of a Navi,
right,
as opposed to a king who's like sovereign and he creates like a certain centralized power, and people wanted that. They wanted to have the security in a king who's a strong, powerful guy with his army and his, you know, like they look up to him as like somehow Miss Majestic, and that's, I think, could be better to be centered around a Navi who's his Chacham, who teaches ideas, and it doesn't have the majesty of a king. But they wanted that. That was the Chet, is that they, you know. It could be, it's like.
What's supposed to happen eventually?
It sounds like it. That's the problem, is that they were convinced there. Is it because of a weakness in man that they need it, or is it intrinsically that we should have that? I don't know. Maybe it's intrinsically it's going to happen because man does need it. But insofar as we don't. I don't know. It's a good question. I haven't analyzed the area in a while.
Well, it's in the Torah, then you have to
say. I know. It seems so. It seems like it's in the Torah, but then if it's in the Torah.
It's in the Torah because
what?
Of like some sort
yeah.
of emotional need that like the people needed it emotionally, or is it because this is like the most perfect state in which
right.
we're governed?
Right, and if in an era where they don't need it, maybe they don't have it. Because you see, if it was in the Torah, well, they didn't have one for a long time. So maybe it's in the Torah. If you need it, then you can have it. And here's the system that does it. You want an Melech? Here are the rules. But you want? You don't need one. So it could be, yeah. But there is a time where people do need it, and this is the way you do it. So sounds that way because you know, and then that's why they can be criticized for asking for it, because it's an optional institution which depends upon your needs. And if you're saying it, we need it like all the nations. They said we want a king like all the nations who are around us. So, well, that's not the right way to, you know. But at the same time, the Torah recognizes that there is a time where people feel like they need it, and it sets up a system. But he's criticizing them by saying is you'd be better off if you didn't go for it, if you would have stayed on the Navi track, you know. But if you need it, then you need it, and we'll put that system in place.
Like our idea of kings, like it doesn't really seem to fit with how a Jewish king would act. I mean, like in a Jewish society, like there's not really laws or things like that, or things that the Jewish king would demand. You simply just enforce the laws.
Yes, but he, you know, he makes political decisions about going to war. He sets up an army. He has justice. There's din. There's din of a Melech also. Like a king could execute people not based upon like Edom. There are certain technicalities of the way the halachic system works that a king has the right to be extrajudicial type of justice. Like we're outside of the technicalities of the halachic system. That's an insert to a king to do. Like let's say a guy, you know, a guy's killing, but he doesn't have appropriate witnesses or whatever. It's some sort of way that you know that it's shown, but you can't nail him on the technical.
So the king could just be
king
like,
king
you
just
know,
kill him.
You know this guy
yeah, right. Yeah, the king has the right to do justice outside. So it's like there is a role where there's the king's justice and there's Bezdin's justice, and they kind of work together. You know, the king,
so
I
the
think,
king could function, so to speak, outside
to
of
the fill form. In like certain like gaps in the halakhic system. You know, like as a system, the system is designed in a certain way, but there are certain like loopholes or certain way that a system is structured. And I think the king has rights beyond that. Yeah, it might be beneficial in that regard. And he also organizes an army, and he's like.
Right, other than yeah, the army. And
yeah,
the
so that's a big thing. That's part of the ask for it.
Other nations,
yeah.
I can understand. But
yeah, right.
Are there in fact loopholes?
Well, there's ways, is that. Yeah, loopholes mean that we don't just kill people so easily. Like, the system is set up in a way that you try not to kill people. In order to kill someone, he has to really be a very, very flagrant violator. So like if they aid them, they have to warn him, and immediately he has to say, I don't care, I'm doing it anyways, you know, when you do this you're going to kill you, I don't care, I'm doing it anyways, and he does it. And it's like it's almost like you have to be like on a suicide mission to get yourself killed by a Bezdin. And they said a Bezdin kill once in 7 years would be like a bloody Bezdin. You know, it wasn't common that Bezdin killed people, and there are ways to do it if people are. There are ways, if you're trying to like avoid getting killed by the courts, you could. But at the same time, the society can get out of hand. So a king has the right to kill those people. It's like part of the mishpat of Melech, that he's not bound by the legal technicalities of the system of mishpat. I mean, I'm just trying to tell you about it, but I don't know, it'd be interesting to study exactly the, you know, why. I'm not saying I fully understand that, but that is the case. I haven't really gone into it much. But yeah.
I don't know if I heard you, if you said this or not, but does the king have a power to implement justice without the base then?
Yes.
He does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know exactly the parameters of it, but yes, he does.
I see. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, Tamar?
I think my question's actually a little bit too
long.
It's too long, yeah.
Okay. Do you want to just tell me, then we can talk about it?
Yeah, I mean, basically the question is just, like, it's, like, something I guess I've thought about before to some degree, but, like, kind of, like, what the role of Tormesina is in your thinking after you've already learned it and then done some other learning and have some, like, you know, depth of knowledge. Like,
done what?
Like, some like, exposure on, like, death and, like, what Tor is about, like, in terms of just seeing
right. I mean, what's the role of Tormesina? Is Tormesina still a fun, the foundational thing, or is it just, like, to get you started?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, any other questions?
I guess I have a quick follow-up question.
Okay.
I know, like, by the Kashrus and by Kaelin, like, things become, like, they absorb Tom, and that's what we hold, like, you say, like, okay, it has Tom, and,
yeah.
But if, let's say, there was a Klee that, like, we find that does not, that does not porous at all, and you know, we scientifically prove that it does not absorb any
right.
flavors.
Right.
Would that Klee still fall under, like, the magnetic conditions, which can't be used for 24 hours or whatever?
Good question. You can ask Carpathia something about it. There's something about plastic, some sort of, like, what type of material are you talking about?
Well, for one, glass.
Glass. And a glass.
But then that also calls into question a lot of, like China is all coated in glass.
Mm-hmm, I understand.
And from what I understand, at least, there's no pores.
Really? Yeah, I remember there's something like that by plastic, something like that. I don't remember the details, though, or whatever.
Sure, plastic's also like that. Not
yeah, yeah, I'm not, I don't know, I'm not the guy to ask about this. Esher Pesach. This is his area. You know, I don't know. Good question.
But just in terms of, like, halakha, like, if, like, would that...
Would it matter?
Would it matter if scientifically it was proven that it would? Can that overrule?
No. It's a good question. It's a good question, I know. You're asking more general question.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, both.
Is it,
both
like, is it, like...
In this case, but, like, as well, like, if,
right.
like, something like that occurred...
Right,
like,
I understand.
Like,
I mean, I guess it would depend upon the halacha of how it's codified. I'm not, I don't, like, in theory, something like that could be dependent upon the facts. But.
It seems like a practical matter, and if it's just not practical, then.
Yes. I don't know. It's a good question. Let's go on for a Pesach. You can ask him if. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know enough about this, I guess. It's hard to question. When you do kashas, you're always wondering those kinds of things. Because they do the sugyas, they're like very, very halachic. And you're just kind of wondering, like, what are the facts here?
Right.
I know. It's like, it would be interesting for you to go through those areas, I'm sure it would be. I mean, I wonder if you'd have, like, a different take on this, different type of insights into the areas
right.
of God, the sugyas, you know? It might be interesting. For Pesach, the holding that stuff like crazy,
yes.
you know?
Yeah.
But it'll be interesting to go for you to do this, I guess.
Yeah.
You should try that. That'll be interesting for you, I'm
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, I've had to go through, like, a lot of
halachas. Oh, just when you're cooking stuff. Yeah. But usually do the sugyas, and again, I wonder if you'd have a good intuition. You know, like, sometimes in different sugyas, there's, like, the intuitive sense that you have about the area, which kind of can help guide you, and of course you're going to have to, like, define it and all that, but I do think there is an intuition in an area that comes from, you know, if you have a, you know, probably have a good sense about the way things work, and then, you know, it'd be interesting to see how sugyas codify these things, you know?
Right.
Yeah, if you find that an answer, you can let me know, if you ask him.
I know that, I believe smart use plastic,
glass. Glass, right? Yeah, glass. I think so. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? Are we done? Is that, yeah?
Question?
Yeah.
I guess it's from this week's parsha.
Okay.
It also goes back to Yisro.
Yeah.
And it's like a whole, it's more in Shavuos, it's like a whole, like, midrashic, you know, thing going on when Asa Vinishma. They're like, I mean, I guess we translate as we got crowns, but it says in this video. So, like, 600,000 malachim were there to put on two crowns, and then they had 1,200,000 to take them off when after the eagle.
Mm-hmm.
And also, and then this week's parsha is like Hashem, like after he says, like, you know, take off all your crowns.
Right.
You can't wear them anymore. And the Midrash continues, actually says Moshe brought them into his possession.
Yeah.
But I just want to know what were these crowns?
What are they?
But like, there was some guy just like,
yeah, that's a good question.
And what does edio, I guess, literally mean?
I think it's like adornments or something, no? Adornments, adi. I think adi, interior
man. And I think Uncle's has a different translation. He translated as like tikkun zive.
Tikkun zive, oh yeah, right, weapons.
Yeah.
Right, that's what the Ramban talks about that. See what he says.
So it's like, you know, like, Uncle's didn't think it was a crown.
That's true. And he says, it's supposed to say that there are weapons that they have. They had the cover that they had weapons that are protecting them from death. The Ramana's whole thing is protecting them from death. Because having the Ramana would say that they weren't going to die. Because of the Chedei Egel, they accepted upon themselves Misa. They did Tshuva. He has a whole shot.
So then, does he learn that they had two weapons?
Weapons protect them from Shalos Malchamavas. Oh, I don't know. He doesn't mention that Medrash. Where's that Medrash? Where do you see that?
Shabbos? I don't know.
Somewhere.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How do you come across it? You saw.
It was the Rashi wrote
that. Oh, Rashi referenced it on this parsha.
Yeah. In,
did Rebbe give a share about that once? I don't know. Really? I think he gave a share about it once. What these things are, what the crowns are. I seem to remember it was a Sunday share once. The whole area. I think I was there maybe. I don't think I ever listened to crowns. I think Rabbi Zimmer may have a shot about it. It sounds familiar. So I think maybe this year it's called like the low entropy Torah crowns or something like that. I forget. He has a shot, I think. Could ask him about it, but I don't know. Good question, but I have no idea. Strange. And it's a strange part of the Torah. You don't even know what it's talking about at all.
This whole part.
Not even a shot.
It's too much going on.
A lot of stuff. I know. It's a pretty busy parsha, right?
The Moshe's face just glows.
Yeah.
Ended off on a nice note.
Yeah. Yeah, that never really good. Yeah, a lot going on. Yeah. All right, any others?
I have one.
Yeah.
Not so important. I don't know if you see the art school commentary to the Haftor of the Parshas Fargo.
I didn't.
Okay. Well, he quotes a Rav Hirsch.
Okay.
That talks about this idea about big tummy.
Okay.
And didn't totally understand it. But my question is really just, what does it mean to be tummy? And if tummy means that somehow you're farther away from what serving God is.
Right.
How is it that, you know, not even necessarily the question about the power of Duma, but Focus, right? You can't answer that.
Right.
But not, let's say, I work in another condition.
Okay.
Right? And he's doing a tahara on a body.
Right.
And now he's tummy. Mm-hmm. Literally engaged in chesed shel emes. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And somehow the result is that he's farther away from someplace where he's supposed to be.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, like, what does it mean to be tummy? He's not fit for avoda. He's not fit to he's bound by some sort of physical limitation that's going to hold back his intellectual, spiritual pursuits.
Mm-hmm. Right. Question. So, I think the Rambam talks about
lowering his avoda.
Yeah. Tomorrow about. I mean, the main thing, you're asking a particular question, which, let's just ignore your particular question, which is a hard one for starters, but, you know, if you have to go, you can know, if you have to go. Right? If you have to go. Okay. Yeah, so he says, so if we can get to the Chavikdisha question for a moment, let's just, maybe we'll get back to it later. But he says that the idea is that a person has to know, there's like a, the Torah wanted to set up that you can't just go into the Mikdash at any time. If a person would be able to go into the Mikdash every day, then it would become stale. It would become like, it wouldn't be an important event. You know, the Mikdash is like a special thing where a person goes to before God. And it's designed to be like an inspirational, moving experience. See, it's like a beautiful place, it smells awesome, and it's like the whole experience with the kohanim and the clothing and the, you know, and then you went in there and you were emotional and they're singing and you'd go in there and you'd be moved emotionally, and then the kohanim would teach you ideas, the kohanim and levim would, like the teachers, the chachamim. And they'd do avoda, and they'd help you do tshuva, and they'd bring you, it would be like a whole experience of a person going and becoming close to God, you know, on through his multifaceted experience, you know, like a multimedia, you know, moving experience of, you know, and then they'd show you the menorah, and you'd see the different ideas and all the kelim and the avoda. It's like, you know, unbelievable experience. And part of what makes it unbelievable is that you can't just go to the Mikdash. It becomes a trip and an awesome experience because you have to prepare to go to the Mikdash. And there are certain things that make you enable you to go, and other things just don't. So if you happen to bump into a sheretz or a mace or a whatever, or you know, various things in life, that you can't go into the Mikdash. So it's, you have to really work to be able to do it, and you have to be on guard and vigilant and careful, you know. And sometimes you're, you know, maybe you go a few times a year around, you know, it's not so simple. So what that ends up doing is it creates a aura to the Mikdash, you know? And that's by design, that there should be an experience of going to the Mikdash. Now, but how exactly is it brought about? Do you just say, you know, on Tuesdays you pick a random number and you go into the Mikdash on that day of the month? You know, so the Torah didn't do that. But rather, it set up a system of Taman Taira. And Tame means there are certain things that you encounter which makes you distant from Mikdash. You're not fit to go into the Mikdash. And that Tame just means you're removed from Mikdash. You're not in the state where you're able to go to the Mikdash. Now, why are... So, that's the main idea. Now the question is, okay, so now... why were these things chosen and not other things chosen? You know, it could have been that if you, you know, open a book, you become Tamei or whatever, you know. So that's like a similar question to like the idea of kashrus is that you have self-control over your repetitive instinct. Now, why is it pig and why is it split hose and why is it... That's like a more particular question about why the particular is chosen, you know what I mean? So, right, you're with me? So I think, the way I understand it is that there are certain... they're not arbitrary things chosen for Tama, but there are various encounters which reflect ideas which are distance the person from God. And therefore the particulars which are chosen are things which categorically reflect distance, you know, which reflect the lower level of Adam. And therefore the particulars which are set up to be Tama to each are Tame, are not just arbitrary, but they're things which categorically reflect the lower level, you know. So like tzaras is, you know, medame, and tzaras is like the Farshan Hara, you know, or like a sheretz is like certain touches on certain base primitive like parts of a person, you know, and like tame animals or something shan kosher kind of sort of movie from, or like zav and zav are certain illnesses which are somehow bring a person away from God. And I think a mace, the idea of a mace is that a mace is like a person or that is a neshama, or that is samalakam. You know, it's like total physicality. You know, so like a person, this higher element of a person is non-physical. But when a person dies, they just become a corpse and they're just a physical body. So an encounter with that brings you to face with the physical man as a physical being only. You know, so that encounter...
Is that saying that
affects the psyche in a certain way? Or
well, no. It might, but the point is it doesn't mean in each case it does. I mean, in David's case, maybe it may affect you in a good way because you're doing chesed or whatever. But it's saying is, in theory, an encounter with the mace brings you, you know, brings you in touch with the physical part of man.
It reflects
a certain idea, and therefore that idea, that category was chosen not when you encounter a book, but when you encounter a mace. It's not just an arbitrary thing which is chosen. It doesn't mean each person who bumps into a mace is now not fit to go before God, but it means a system, God wanted to set it up that there are categories of that it's hard to go to before God, and the particulars are chosen as things which bring to mind concepts, and they kind of bring to mind an idea. A person should strive to be in the world of life, because the essence of man is son Elohim and not his physical body. So it teaches you that concept. When you go before God, you should think the essence of man is the son Elohim, not your physical body. As is evidenced by the fact that when I'm encountering a physical body, I can't go into the mikdash. Oh, so that shows you, it points out the concept that service of God and going before God is about service with your mind, and therefore that, you know, involvement with pure physicality distances you from God. You know, so it doesn't mean the particular cases, you know. And I think it was, I don't know if someone said this or this is a pshat, it's like a nida also. I said a pshat, that's what nida is that a nida is in the time of the month where a woman can't get pregnant, is when she's a nida, because that's when she's menstruating. It's like the, so that's where like a woman at that time is pure, sex with a woman at that time would be totally physical. You know, so it would be removed from any capability of kiyamamen, of reproduction. So it's saying is like in that state, the woman represents like purely a rubio with that woman would represent purely a physical act without any potential of, reproduction. So that the person, that also brings an encounter with Anida is an encounter with somebody who is no role in a higher objective of sexual. You know, so that's another you know, particular.
Also, I think Rambam mentioned that as well, that there's another category of like Tumantara, another reason for its institution,
okay.
was that it was like there was pre Torah, there was some sort of concept of like tuma and tar, not like
okay.
Tall tuma and tar, but there was like, and it's a similar idea to like sacrifices, like why are
okay.
We doing sacrifices? Is that continue?
Oh yeah, took it and how to fight it.
So there was some sort of like, especially by women who like were Nida, like the,
right.
There was like
taboos or whatever.
There were taboos that existed, and they like would like send the women out, and you weren't women weren't allowed to leave the house, and like it was a primitive way of looking at it, and there were some taboos.
So what does he say? So the Torah took those and made them halachic or something?
And made them halachic.
Okay, I don't remember that, but sounds.
That's why he like kind of uses the usage of a system of like the Tumah Tara.
It makes it halachified and takes it out of being a primitive thing and makes it
built
into the halachic system.
Right.
Okay. That's good. Yeah, so that's what I'm saying. It's like the particular, it isn't, you know, it's not about the particular guy who does it, but it's more the concept. You know, so if you want to go to the Mikdash and you're in the Chevra Kedisha, then maybe you'll take a month off and, you know, whatever it is, you know. But it's not because of a particular guy, it's more just the concept of involvement with the mace is involvement with that part of man. You know what I mean? Yes, but it's a halachic idea. You know, it becomes halachic, but there's the philosophy is like kind of what underlies the halacha, you know? Yeah. Okay. Good. Okay. Anyone else? Are you done? Okay. I guess we're done? Sounds good. Good. Gotta go with the crowd.